This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
Now to human DNA and our great guest this evening, Sid Mukherjee. Back in 2001, when the Pulitzer Committee awarded Sid the nonfiction prize, it praised The Emperor of All Maladies as, quote, an elegant inquiry, at once clinical and personal. Well, he's done it again in his new book, The Gene, which tells the story of the development of genetics by weaving science and social history with some personal narrative about his own relatives. As Sid recalls in the acknowledgments, he was actually so physically and mentally exhausted after Emperor that he hadn't expected to write another book. But The Gene turns out to be a natural pairing with Emperor, a sort of a prequel, he calls it, in that it focuses on biological normalcy before things get distorted into the malignancy of cancer. If you've ever wondered how much of our lives is determined by our genes versus how much depends on external environmental factors, you need to read Sid's new book. But don't expect a simple answer, because as you'll hear from Sid in a minute, it's complicated. A word about Sid's own past. As far back as his student days, which were just a couple of decades or so ago, he was already distinguishing himself. He attended Stanford, went to Rhodes, studied immunology at Oxford, then went to Harvard Medical School. Today, he's an assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University and a staff cancer physician at Columbia's Medical Center. Sid's going to be in conversation here this evening with someone who has obviously made excellent use of her own genes, Judy Woodruff, the co-anchor and managing editor of the PBS NewsHour and one of the most accomplished journalism in television today. So please join me in welcoming both Sid Mukherjee and Judy Woodruff.
Thank you, Brad Graham, for that very gracious. Nobody's ever introduced me before by saying good jeans.
What you have?
Except when they were talking about my blue jeans, I guess. Thank you. If you were captivated by The Emperor of All Maladies, you will be more than captivated by The Gene.
Oh, thank you for saying that.
And Intimate History. I feel like my mic is a little bit loud. So
I'm going to speak softly.
Sid, there are so many ways I'd like to begin, but I think hearing your personal story about why, after you had completed the years you had worked on the book about cancer, and as we just heard from Brad, you said you were exhausted by that, but then something else was going on in your mind about your own family, and you write about that in a way that just pulls every reader in the very beginning of the book. What happened? I mean, what was going on in your life that caused you to even think about writing this?
So, interestingly, I think I conceived of The Gene. I didn't think of it as that's the name of the book, but I thought about The Gene for a long time, simply because as I was growing up, I had this crisscrossing history of mental illness in my family, schizophrenia and bipolar disease in particular. I had two uncles, one with schizophrenia and one with bipolar disease. They actually died having lived with that. For many years. One of these uncles lived with my family while I was growing up, was very much part of my family. And then, sometime in my childhood, my cousin, again from my father's side, all the same side of the family, was also diagnosed and institutionalized. And that, you know, that elephant in the room, I suppose it's the right analogy for India, but that elephant in the room could not go away. It would not go away. You know, like most Bengali families, my parents had elevated denial to a museum-grade art, but they couldn't deny it anymore, especially my father couldn't deny it anymore, the idea that this was very much part of his life, mental illness, and the heredity component of mental illness. And that's when we began to talk about it. So while I was in medical school, while I was writing Emperor, while I was treating patients, all of this history, the story, was constantly in the back. It was like a buzz that goes in the back of your head, you know? Am I exposed? Am I vulnerable? Who else is? What does it look like? What, you know, is there a trigger that's needed, that's missing or present, etc.? So this story was my story long before cancer was my story, or became my story. And in fact, when I finished writing Emperor of All Maladies, I thought to myself, maybe I won't write another book, I'll be done. And then I kept coming back to this idea, you know, this idea of, and as I said, it was like Star Wars, it was like a prequel to the sequel.
You dedicate the book to two people. We're going to get to one of them in a minute, but one of them was your own grandmother.
Yeah.
Because she was involved very much in taking care of your uncles who were, as you say, mentally ill. And so there's a powerful story there. There's also a story I want you to just read a little bit from the start of the book where you were with your father and you went to visit your cousin.
Yeah.
You want
to... Yeah, I'll just read a little bit from that. Just to, you know, this is where the story really begins. So this is actually just the very first, this is the prologue of the book. It's titled Families, and it's got a little epigram. The blood of your parents is not lost in you. It's got another epigram, I'm going to read the other epigram. In the winter of 2012, I traveled from Delhi to Calcutta to visit my cousin, Moni. My father accompanied me as a guide and companion, but he was a sullen and brooding presence, lost in a private anguish that I could only sense dimly. My father is the youngest of five brothers, and Moni is his firstborn nephew, the eldest brother's son. Since 2004, when he was 40, Moni has been confined to an institution for the mentally ill with a diagnosis of schizophrenia. He's kept densely medicated, awash in a sea of assorted antipsychotics and sedatives, and has an attendant watch, bathe, and feed him throughout the day. My father has never accepted Moni's diagnosis. Over the years, he has waged a lonely counter-campaign against the psychiatrist charged with his nephew's care, hoping to convince them that their diagnosis was somehow a colossal error or that Moni's broken psyche would somehow magically mend itself. My father has visited the institution in Calcutta twice, once without warning, hoping to see a transformed Moni living a secretly normal life behind the barred gates. But my father knew, and I knew, that there was more than just avuncular love at stake for him in these visits. Moni's not the only member of my father's family with mental illness. Of my father's four brothers, two suffered from various unravelings of the mind. Madness, it turns out, has been among the Mukherjees for at least two generations, and at least part of my father's reluctance to accept Moni's diagnosis lies in his grim recognition that some kernel of the illness might be buried like toxic waste in himself. So that's the first paragraph of the book.
So it's in your family. You saw it when you were growing up. You heard stories about it. As we said, your grandmother was very much an influential figure in your life, and you saw how she was toward your uncles.
Now, they came to live with us because he was no longer able to take care of himself. So in this nuclear family, growing up with the aspirations of a nuclear family in Delhi was also present, a remnant of the past, because both of them had moved in with us by then.
And for you, years later, as a scientist, just the idea that in your family, you were constantly, you write, thinking about this, in your family, it was one generation and the next, but it wasn't everybody in the family, it wasn't every cousin or...
Absolutely not, yeah.
...was certainly not you. But that was the impetus that brought you to think, we need... You wanted to spend more time looking at the gene, the genetic mystery. There's a connection to cancer, the first book. But you really were embarking on a completely different and ambitious story that you wanted to tell.
And you know, I published a small excerpt from this book in The New Yorker on schizophrenia with a picture of me and my father. That was really the first thing I really wrote. I sat on it for many, many years. I didn't publish it. I didn't do anything with it. but it was the first thing that I wrote. In fact, it was the first thing that I wrote once I finished Emperor. And I wrote it privately, didn't publish it at all, didn't give it out to anyone. It was just part of my healing or writing process. And what's interesting about it, I went back to it. Now that, you know, you're sitting down here, I went back to it. And genetics, at least, it doesn't really rear its full head in that little thing that I wrote back then. It's about family, which is why the prologue is called Families. The idea of genetic genes doesn't come into it. It's a reminder that, you know, we think of this word gene and it's suffused our culture and it seems to be sort of an abstract concept that lies outside ourselves in science. You know, people are talking about it in laboratories. But family, genes have to do with family. It has to do with us. It has to do with how you and I are made. Who in this room doesn't have a relative who's affected by some illness, which you can ultimately track back to some interaction between genes and environment. So all of a sudden, when I look back at that little thing, it was more than probably 6 pages or 7 pages, I said to myself, you know, this is really about families. It's about ourselves as living organisms that emanate out of these things called genes. And that's sort of the conception of the book.
You wrote this, and before I ask you about, you know, some of the history here and some of the amazing figures you write about, you write this with a sense, I mean, I get a sense of real urgency from you that you felt it was important to get this down now because there's a lot going on in science. And you and I talked about this earlier today. You had a sense that it's really important for people to begin to understand themselves, not to just leave this up to the experts.
Well, let me just give you a sense of what's going on in science, and this may help us have this conversation as we move forward. We're learning to read and write the human genome. And I'm saying this very flatly because let me explain what reading and writing the human genome means. By reading, I mean that, you know, obviously all of you know that in around 2001, 2002, we obtained the sequence of the human genome. And by that I mean, well, let's first define what the genome is. A genome is the entire repository of genetic information that is in your cells, that's in an embryo, that's in human embryos, and it's written in just it's a 4-alphabet code, A, C, G, and T. So your genome might read A, C, G, T, C, C, C. I'm making it up. G, G, G. I haven't memorized it. T, 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 C, 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 and so forth. But here's what's interesting about it. This goes on in humans for 3 billion letters. If you imagine it as a written as an encyclopedia, this encyclopedia would be 66 full sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. So it would line up all the edges of this room. And if you picked up one of these 66 full sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica, it would read A, C, T, G, C, 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 T, C, C. It would be inscrutable to you and me. And yet, here's what's amazing about it. Yet, out of that seemingly inscrutable four-letter code is built you and me and everyone else in that room. It's an astonishing fact that code becomes you, becomes me. Small variations in that code are responsible in some part the difference between you and me. So going back now to understand what the technologies allow us to do, number one is that we're beginning to read that code and beginning to, and I should emphasize very clearly, that we're beginning to be able to predict what might happen in your future for some parts of that genome. Just to give you one example, if you have the BRCA1 gene mutation, it's not 100% chance that you're going to have breast cancer, but your risk of breast cancer may be 10 times higher than the women who don't have that particular mutation. Mm. Yeah. If you have the cystic fibrosis gene mutation in both parental and from both your father and mother, the chances are nearly 100% that you will have that disease in your future. I could tell you that when you were an embryo. If you had the Tay-Sachs disease mutation, I could tell you from your embryonic cell, I could tell you chances that you will have that disease is 100%, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's reading the genome, and now we're getting to more complicated things. I could tell you potentially more complicated things about illness. And people have started to explore far from there yet, but people have started to explore not just illness, but I could tell you complicated things about potentially our identity. That's already entering territory that we should have some moral concerns about. That's one. And writing the genome means that not only can I do that in just reading it, I can actually go now and make directional changes, intentional changes in the human genome using a whole new set of technologies, astonishing technologies that we've hijacked from bacteria and learned to use as humans. And these technologies allow us to go into that 66-volume encyclopedia. Again, remember, 66 volumes. Pick out one volume, erase one word in that encyclopedia, and put it back in, leaving, we think, we're not sure about it yet, leaving all the other 66 volumes untouched. So it seems to me that once we've acquired these technologies, we need to talk about them. We need to talk about them. You need to learn about them. I need to learn about them. We cannot let this happen in the laboratory. Mm-hmm. Last week, there was a closed-door meeting at Harvard where they proposed synthesizing the entire human genome by stitching together single ACTGs, basically, like a little bead on a string. In other words, you could synthesize, technologies would soon become available, that you could take the entire human genome and make it from scratch. Not a science fiction fantasy. We're not there yet. But all the technologies that allow us to get there are being assembled. And this is the time to think about things. This is the time for me to think about mental illness, for you to think about whatever other illnesses and mechanisms of variation and identity that you may be interested in. This is the time to think about it. This is the time to converse about it. And if you don't, we will give this unbelievably important piece of our history and our future to people that we might not want to give it to.
And you, in the book, among other things, you write about a period not so long ago when the study of genetics was heading off in a really terrible direction, and we know it led to some pretty horrible things on this planet. But I want you to go back, though, on a little bit of the history here, because
yes.
So much of what you just described, Sid, it happened in the last 10 or 15 years, mm-hmm. or even
last month.
But, you know, you also, you know, it's humbling to know that Aristotle was thinking about this, and that the information kind of sat there, and then it was another couple of thousand years before, or almost a thousand years, before Charles Darwin started doing his work, and then after that, some other really interesting characters. And there are almost these signposts along the way of people who worked on genetics or worked on what they may not have even known was genetics, but it all came together later to be critical. Talk a little bit about some of that early work that was done. People know Charles Darwin.
Right.
Well,
let's start with, you know, what's interesting about it, and certainly we'll touch on Aristotle in a second, what's interesting about it is that, of course, this is a perennial question. I mean, since the dawn of human history, you can imagine one of the first questions we asked ourselves is, why do we look like our parents? Or why do we not look like our parents? These two simultaneous contradictions, the yin and yang, the two strands, as it were, of these questions have been part of our DNA, cultural DNA, forever. Who hasn't asked that question? When an illness strikes a family, we've asked ourselves, why did it not strike my father or my mother? Why is it mine? And so forth. I mean, variations. When two identical twins are born, we say, well, why do they look like the same? And so forth. So Aristotle had a theory about this. Aristotle really began to think about this very seriously. And it's an astonishing fact that, you know, Aristotle was an okay philosopher, but he was a very good biologist.
Which I venture to say most people didn't realize.
Yes. You know, actually, what's interesting about Aristotle, at least from reading him from my very particular tinted lenses, I see him as a biologist completely. I see him as a philosopher only secondarily. His philosophy really emanated out of his desire to taxonomize, to divide the world up in different organic forms. You know, what was form looked like, what was... So Aristotle realized, or he made the argument, that what was really moving, what was really being transmitted across generations was a message, was some kind of message. And he has a lovely phrase. He said, it's a little bit like a carpenter shaping a piece of wood. when the carpenter shapes a piece of wood, he was talking about how organisms are formed, how a human being is formed. He said, when a carpenter shapes a piece of wood, he doesn't shape it in a material way. What he does is he transmits an information, as it were, through his handiwork or her handiwork, into that piece of wood. And that's what happens. He's transmitting information, a message, into that piece of wood, and that's what makes that wood piece of wood acquire whatever form. This was back in, you know, when he writes this, but this was back in the day when people were debating about, you know, how gods gave us forms and so forth. So that's Aristotle, and then there's a long silence, really, after that. For a while, people thought, I'll give you one more highlight, and they'll come to more modern characters. For a while, people thought that, this was the greatest one of them all, for a while, people thought that, in fact, this was so complicated. I mean, they said, how on earth can a fully formed human being, an embryo, develop out of when a woman conceives, how can that possibly happen? And they made the argument, it was an argument made in the 1600s, that in fact a tiny miniature human being was sitting inside sperm, right, wrapped up like this. In fact, they drew pictures of it too. And if you thought about it carefully, then it had to be the case that since that homunculus, as it was called, would also generate its own children, a mini homunculus had to be sitting inside that homunculus, right? And so forth.
And so on. Infinitely.
Infinitely. Infinitely miniaturized homunculi, which was a lovely idea, of course. A little crazy if you think about it, like Russian dolls stretching out towards the future. But this was actually one of the most popular ideas about how we transmitted likeness, which was of course the center of the gene.
But what he figured out or what he thought about and shared really kind of sat there, as we said, for a couple thousand years. Along comes Charles Darwin, who did some important work in all this. But then there were some others who came along who really were not appreciated at the time. One of them was a monk.
Yes.
Who you spend, I think, some really interesting pages on.
It's a fascinating story. And so that's Gregor Mendel. Gregor Mendel really launches the book and the modern history of genes. And because Mendel's a monk. Actually, it's very interesting that both Darwin and Mendel are monks. It's instructive about our times that there was a time that people with spiritual lives found no contradiction between exploring the universe in its material form as well as having spiritual lives. Someone should read Darwin and Mendel, or force people to read Darwin and Mendel. I suppose the capacity and the compassion that they brought to their, and the passion that they brought to that, to their individual scientific explorations was incredible. But Mendel, fascinating character, he was a monk, and he began sort of to do extremely simplified experiments. That was his trick. He was a great gardener. And his trick, his main insight, was to simplify this morass of ideas around genetics. You know, homunculus is sitting inside homunculus. And he said, I'm going to forget all about that in a second. And all I'm going to do is I'm going to study with almost monastic concentration. I'm going to study what happens to one or two, he actually seven individual features across multiple generations of peas. Right? Here were people talking about, you know, hugely complex experiments about human embryology and how we were born. There was Mendel sitting in a small monastery at the edge of the city of Brno, where he said, all I'm going to do is I'm going to study seven characters. I'm going to map them as they move. He didn't coin the word gene. He had no idea what these things were. And at the end of it, just by mathematical reasoning, he realized that there has got to be something, that units of information, again, going back to Aristotle, units of information must be passing between the parent and the offspring.
And he was trying to understand. In fact, he wanted to work with mice, but his superiors wouldn't let him.
That's right, because mice was a little bit too risque. I mean, peas They're far away enough from us, but mice is a little scary. I have a great, lovely story about it. So I spent some time in Mendel's Monastery. It's a beautiful place. And one quick story, and we'll move on. But I went to Mendel's Monastery in Brno, and I traveled. And you can get to it easily from Vienna, but it's a little bit of a schlep. So I traveled over to Mendel's Monastery, and I arrived there, and there was a woman at the front desk, and I said, I've come all this way. I want to go and see the birthplace of biology, right? The place that was like a pilgrimage for me. And she said, I'm sorry, you have to apply in triplicate. The monastery's closed. So I said, this is the Czech Republic. So I pleaded, I've come from all this way. All I want to do is I want to be inside. I want to see the library. And she said, no, you have to send an application. And I said, well, who do I apply to? And completely without any irony, she said, to me. And so I'm from India. And I said, two can play at this game. So I said, I hereby apply to you. With a little bow, I said, I hereby apply to you. And so she was defeated, and she let me in. She let me in. So that was my trip to Mendel's Monastery. I spent about 4 or 5 days. You can't stay there, but I spent 4 or 5 days going back and forth, being in the library, looking at that first garden where he planted those peas that generated this thing, which has now taken over the world.
And the work that he did wasn't appreciated for a long time. In fact, it sat obscure, and he was scorned. But at some point, there were a number of other important figures. Remind us, who came up with the term genetics?
So it was
somebody gets credit for that.
That's right. It was much later. Again, remember, Mendel doesn't even have that word in his vocabulary. He knows that he's stumbled on something interesting. But what's amazing about Mendel is that once he's stumbled,
Go ahead. Because he fired off, once he had done this work, it was so fast. He sent his copies of his report, he condensed it, to 40-some pages.
That's right.
Sent it out to all these scholarly centers, but it was just dismissed.
Basically everyone said, what is this crazy monk writing about? And why should we be reading this stuff? And they went on describing botany and physiology and trying to figure out how embryos were formed in their very complicated ways, homunculus is falling into homunculus and so forth. God knows. But anyway, but then in the 1900s, Mendel gets rediscovered. And soon after, in 1909, we find the word gene, because botanists and biologists begin to say to themselves, we've got to have a word for this. I mean, there is this abstract. We don't know what it is. We don't know what carries it. Is it a molecule? Is it a structure in a cell? But something carries this information. We know it's important, and so we've got to have a word for it. William Bateson, one of Mendel's great defenders, I talk about him. There's a great picture of him in the book, coins the word genetics from genus, generation, genius, all of these words coming together in that word. And so he coins the word gene or genetics. And then his colleague, Johansson, says, you know, that's the discipline. Genetics is the discipline. We have to name that thing. And so they name it the gene.
And the work, so it fits and starts. I mean, there's progress, and then there's a setback and more progress. And you do an amazing, a wonderful job of bringing to life these people who really probably led pretty extraordinary lives.
Right.
They were stuck in a lab or in an office somewhere, writing and working. But then you fast forward to the 1950s to Watson and Crick. But before you get to that point, you know, things really go badly off track.
Mm-hmm.
Why did that happen? How did that happen?
So it's important to remember that it's important to remember that off track, because while the gene is being explored scientifically, the study of heredity, of course, has a long history. Mm-hmm. And the desire to manipulate heredity is not, there were really parallel studies. And it was in England that, coincidentally, in fact, Darwin's cousin, Francis Galton, invented the term eugenics. Galton didn't know very much about genes. Actually, he had a terrible theory of genetics himself. He made a mistake. It was kind of a homunculus, funnily enough. The mathematical homunculus, I talk about it in the book, but we'll set that aside for a second. But Galton's a fascinating character. He was a great mathematician, a great statistician, but he also lived in Darwin's shadow all his life. I call Galton, you know, he's slung between Darwin and Mendel. I mean, can you imagine these two giants? And you're supposed to, Galton was supposed to be an epic giant himself. He was a child prodigy and tried, of course, had many important contributions to statistics and mathematics. But Galton coins this term eugenics because he thinks that regardless of what the gene is, whether there's a gene or no gene, we can use human heredity. By manipulating heredity, we can make better human beings. And Galton's proposal, he coined the word eugenics, good genes, eugenics, in order to try to make better human beings. He thought that if we breed, selectively breed the best human beings, we'll get a superior, we'll emancipate ourselves. And here's what's astonishing, which I discovered, is that this was considered an incredibly progressive idea, like taking evening walks or, you know, getting constitutional baths in spas and so forth. This was considered a very healthy idea for humankind. And many progressives, some exceptions and some notable exceptions actually, many progressives said this was a great idea, we should do more of this. And so that was Galton, and it took off in England and stayed in England. And that idea then metastasizes and reaches the shores of this country, where it mingles with a kind of Yankee practicality and becomes, it morphs into not just let's breed the best, let's sterilize those who carry bad genes, which ultimately sort of escalates slowly and leads to a case that many people know, Carrie Buck's case. Carrie Buck was a woman who was accused of having genetic imbecility and sterilized on that pretext. And famously, the Oliver Wendell Holmes, the so-called great judicial moderate, the case climbed to his court, and he said, three generations of imbeciles is enough. And Carrie Buck was moved to a state colony, it was called then, and she was forcibly narcotized, taken to an operating theater, and sterilized on that pretext.
And there was no real evidence that she had any mental illness
at
all.
Books have been written about it, and there is basically no evidence that she was a bit of a rebel. That was the worst of her sins.
And you were saying to me earlier today that you felt it was so important, and she's one of the two people you dedicate the book to. It was so important to remind everybody that this is happening, that this happened. It's not just Nazi Germany.
Yes.
Where things
And this was just finish up that story. Thanks for catching me. It metastasizes again and then moves from selective breeding to selective sterilization to selective extermination. And that's the final incarnation. That's the final and the macabre incarnation that eugenics takes, which we now remember it by. We remember Nazi eugenics, beginning with people who had, again, mental illness, moving on to things like depression, and ultimately moving on to the racial and ethnic and human cleansing that the Nazis brought to their full macabre form. And I put that right in the middle of the book.
Right.
In fact, I wanted to start the book with that idea. But then I realized I wanted to start the book actually with the kind of the German episode. But I realized that it's much, much more chilling to watch it happen in front of your own eyes. That the road to that menace, the road to that ghastliness, was paved by progressive feet, by a desire to indeed, the desire to emancipate, the desire for perfectibility, the desire to make ourselves better, ends up in less than 30 years in the extermination of someone who has a mild form of mental illness.
I think we all want to believe that that could never happen again, but as you said a moment ago, because of the incredible advances that have just been made in such a short time, that people really still don't understand. What do you think the possibility is that decisions could get made right now or in the near future that not a repetition of some of the worst of what you described, but we could head off in a direction that it might be very hard to turn around and correct?
Yeah, I'll give you two kinds of examples, and they're relevant today. I'll give you one local, so one example from the United States and one example from internationally. I personally think, having read this story, I think it's very unlikely that we will have a state-mandated form of eugenics in the United States in the future. I don't think that's likely. I think what's interesting and what's much more difficult to contend with is that we're entering an era of personalized eugenics in which we can sequence. This technology is available today. Very soon, you should be able to sequence, and people have done this already in other countries, every single gene of your unborn child. And the question you need to ask yourself is, what do we do with this information? Well, you won't know what to do with this information unless you know what genes are and how they interact with what they produce. So that's of course, one arena that it's important. But meanwhile, let's not forget that the largest, numerically the largest eugenics project is already going on in India and China. In some parts of India, there are 700 women to 1,000 men. In human history, there has never been this skew of gender ratios. That is a eugenics project. Let's not make any bones about it. That is a dysgenics project fostered by science, beginning with ultrasound diagnosis, ending up with, amniocentesis and gender diagnosis through chromosomal analysis, etc. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a dysgenic world. We're already part of it. And it has destabilized societies there. It has destabilized the way we think about it. So it's not someone else's, it's not some other world's problem. This is our world's problem. And the faster we accept it, and the more we understand it, the more armed we will be in able to mitigate against its effects internationally.
It's clearly a case of the science being ahead of where governments, policymakers are prepared to make decisions. But how much of that is a practical effect right here in the United States right now? I mean, you talked a minute ago, Sid, about the work that's being done to edit genes and what you just said about creating a person synthetically.
Creating a genome.
A genome.
Yep.
How much do scientists talk about that? I mean, you're a scientist yourself. How much do scientists sit around and worry about that, think about it? And how much do they talk to policymakers?
Well, they think a lot. They worry a lot about it. The policymakers don't have the language to understand what the implications are often. In fact, scientists don't have the language at all. There's an important meeting, which I describe in the book, that happens in Asilomar, the famous Asilomar conference, when actually my mentor for many years, Paul Berg, I worked with Paul for many, many years, we're still very close friends. Paul and several others, two or three other scientists, discovered the technology to cut and paste genes together in the 1970s. He won a Nobel Prize for this. And essentially, it's relatively simple technology. It is, you take one piece of DNA and you cut it up using tiny molecular scissors that are made by bacteria to kill each other. And you stitch them together with another enzyme, another factor, which is used normally when your DNA strands break because of X-rays, say. Something needs to stitch them back together to maintain their integrity. Mm-hmm. If you just combine these two little pieces, you can suddenly start taking a gene from a frog and stitching it together with a gene from a virus. You can take two genes of any sort. And this is, of course, incredibly important technology. Cancer drugs are made this way. You take it because the genetic code is uniform and universal, you can take a gene from a blue whale and put it into a monkey or monkey cells, and the monkey cells will recognize it for all intents and purposes as if it was a monkey gene and make it as if it was a monkey gene. That's because we are all evolved from the same original organisms and we share the same genetic code. So when this technology was first created, scientists got together and created an open meeting at Asilomar. Journalists came, bioethicists came, policymakers came. They all spent months reading. There was no document about the gene, but they all spent months thinking about, they're collecting all information that they could, learning the vocabulary. And then they had a meeting in which they said, we're going to put a voluntary moratorium for 1 year, it lasts a little bit longer, for 1 year before we can figure out what the next steps are, because this technology may unleash biological catastrophe. So it is possible, I think, at least within the United States, to put moratoria on things before we figure out what to do about them. And in fact, about two months ago, there was a large conference in which they suggested that there should be a moratorium on editing human genes in particular kinds of cells. Certainly not every cell, but embryonic stem cells of certain kinds, although that's unlikely to happen, but certainly human embryos. Meanwhile, there's an experiment in China that was published where they went ahead and tried to make a defined genetic gene editing in a human embryo. And there were non-viable embryos, but they tried 76 embryos, I think, to try to make a defined genetic change.
And what happened? What was the result?
Well, the results, we don't know fully the results because there was published a little piecemeal, and again, there were non-viable embryos. But the quick answer is that in principle, they could make genetic changes in human embryos.
And what does that mean? I mean, what?
That means that in principle, you could, if you tweak the technology, you can do quite a lot of tweaking, but if you tweak the technology, you could say to yourself that I'm interested in, and I talk about how you might tweak that in the real world. The Chinese experiment is actually not a great way to do that experiment. But if you tweak the technology, you could say, I'm going to try to erase the cystic fibrosis mutation from my genetic heritage. I'm going to try to erase the or change a mutation or a variation that causes Alzheimer's disease from my heritage. And in the bizarrest scenario, you could say, I want to add information back to the human genome, which you could do. You could add information to the human genome.
We want to make people taller or something.
Again, to remind us, and I talk about this, it's very important to realize, tallness or height is certainly genetic, but at least 5 or 7 genes govern that. Could you change 5 or 7 genes? Maybe you can. Maybe you could change 5. At least now we're changing 1. But also, as I said, you can add information back to the human genome. That's a surprising thing. We should take that very, very, very seriously.
All right, we're going to be taking questions from all of you in just a couple of minutes. But before we do, just how do we make sure? So be thinking about your questions. But how do we make sure that this kind of work goes in the right direction and not someplace that we don't even want to think
right.
about?
Well, I think there has to be an international consensus. A national consensus won't help because the next thing you know, there's going to be an arms race. China, Korea, India will start making genetic interventions. And I actually outline one possibility, one kind of thought experiment. You know, there's a famous thought experiment that happened when the atom was being split. You know, long before the atomic bomb was made, there's a famous letter that Szilard and Einstein wrote saying, you know, there's no such thing as the atomic bomb, but here's a thought experiment. Just think us, walk just in your brain, walk through this process, and you land up with the unleashing of immense power in a concentrated manner. And Einstein even writes to Szilard and says, writes to the president and says, this could create a weapon of great destruction. Nothing's been made yet. It's just that you can walk the mental steps to it. So I think we need to walk those mental steps first and figure out what the realm of possibilities is. And we need to walk those mental steps internationally so that we can figure out again what the realm of controls is. And I actually suggest a kind of framework by which we hopefully stick to before we enter an era that we don't want to enter.
So we're going to take questions, and I guess there are a couple of microphones. Before they come to the mic, Sid, you know, when I think about what you do, and I think about the book you wrote on cancer and the work you did with public television with WETA, and I should say Sharon Rockefeller here, who's the president of WETA, who worked with you on the film around, and Ken Burns, The Emperor of All Maladies. And I think, how do you even have time to sleep? Because you are a scientist, you're an oncologist, you write books, you're a husband and a father, and you have a life. How do you do it all?
Well, you know, this book came out of such urgency that it had to be written. I sort of prioritized this book over everything else. It took 5.5 years. So, it seems as if it came up one morning, but it took 5.5 years. It took a lot of time, and I spent a lot of time on it. And a lot of it was going back to these stories. I thought to myself, if I can just knit together the stories one after another, I would achieve the book.
It's kind of extraordinary that he can get it all done. All right, let's start over here. And I can't see very well, but step up to the mic and ask your question.
Hi, my name is Andy, and I'll be starting school in the fall to study the intersections of epigenetics and anthropology.
Uh-huh.
And just had a question for you regarding kind of along the lines of this discussion of exploring new frontiers of science.
Uh-huh.
I know you're drawing upon some of the work that you've done on epigenetics, or you've written about on epigenetics, I think we're starting to find a lot more information and evidence about the intergenerational and transgenerational transmissions and inheritance of epigenetic information. And I was wondering, in the spirit of this conversation about understanding the ethical and social considerations of new scientific findings, what those would be for intergenerational and transgenerational.
Yeah, so let me rephrase the question a bit. It's a very important question. The question is, to what extent, so we know that genes transmit information across generations. But lately, there's been a lot of interest in finding out whether your things that happen to you in the environment can also be transmitted across generations. The evidence for that, I think, is very, very minimal right now. It's a totally unexplored frontier. The famous experiment, of course, was Weissman's experiment, in which he dismembered, that it's a gruesome experiment, but he dismembered the tail of one generation of mice. And he waited for the next mouse to be born, and it grew perfectly intact tail. And he dismembered that, and the next generation was born with a tail. And so he kept doing this for multiple generations, and not even 1 centimeter of tail was lost. So we know that, you know, as significant a trauma, as it were, as having a part of your body cut off, in the case of that poor mouse, does not register across multiple generations. It does not get transmitted. And yet we also, there are some inklings that, for instance, starvation, the starvation response, creates changes that are transmitted across multiple generations in ways that we still don't understand. It's an entirely new frontier, and of course it challenges the classical model of how genes transmit information. And we're still trying to figure out what is it? What is the information that's being transmitted? What's amazing about it, and I think I'll just finish with this idea, what's amazing about it is that genes actually protect us from that. Genes were almost designed to wash away the sins of ourselves and our fathers. We reproduce, and all of a sudden all the scars and things that we have in our body are washed away and a baby is formed anew. It's a very beautiful thing that is a very beautiful solution to regeneration. But there is evidence now from, again, very detailed studies on starvation and other in simple organisms that seem to have some effect across generations. We'll have to find out more about it.
We're going to have to find a somewhat more cheerful aspect of genetics. Yes, sir.
Hi, thank you. My name's Scott. And for years we've had this dichotomy between genetics and the environment, what causes social behaviors even, from sociobiology. I've always thought of this as a false dichotomy, in the sense that everything is genetic and everything also is influenced by the environment. And really the question is not whether it's something is genetic or environmentally caused, it's whether or not, how malleable it is. Can it be changed? You know, having poor eyesight is genetic, and yet we can do LASIK surgery, we can wear glasses, and it doesn't affect our behavior. It doesn't affect our genetic fitness, whatever. So really it's a false question. And I was hoping we could talk
actually, about it. I think it's not just a false question. I think it's a question that's led us in the wrong direction. Let me tell you what I think about it, and I write about this in the book extensively. My thought is that when someone asks the question, "Is it nature or nurture? Is it genes or environment?" the first question we should be asking back is, "What are we talking about? What aspect of human behavior or biology are we talking about?" I'll give you some concrete examples. Gender anatomy, the anatomy of gender, is strikingly genetic. There's one gene that governs, for the most part, gender anatomy. If you have it on, it happens to be on the Y chromosome, unsurprisingly. If you have that gene, you will have one particular anatomy of gender and all the physiology that goes along with it. If you don't have that gene, you will have a different anatomy of gender and all the physiology that goes along with it. How do we know this? Because if you have some women inherit the XY, so they are chromosomally male, except that one gene is mutated. And if you mutate that one gene, these women are self-described as women. They have most of their gender anatomy intact. They're often diagnosed as a syndrome called Swyer syndrome, and they're diagnosed because they experience infertility. So gender anatomy, strikingly governed by genes. Gender identity, on the other hand, is a complex mixture, we know that. So the idea, and I talk about these distinctions in the book, so the idea that now we've made a kind of armistice between genes and environment is actually a fool's armistice. There is no armistice. It depends on what level or what level of hierarchy you're examining. It depends on the question you're examining. And it's amazing to me that in this culture, in 2016, the human mind is not capacious enough to understand this simple idea that some things can be strikingly dominated by genes, some things can be strikingly dominated by environments, and some things live in the middle. It depends on what we're asking about. So thank you for saying that.
Thank you. Yes.
Would you please elaborate on the recent developments in treating cancer with gene modification, particularly breast cancer?
Yeah, so right now we're all of these technologies, and this goes back to the point that we're trying to make, all of these technologies can have very powerful effects and a lot of promise. So one of the things that the brain cancer one is the one that comes very quickly to mind. There's a couple of very recent, important, and potentially striking trials of gene therapy in brain cancer using various genetic therapies to treat brain cancers. Certainly, I'll give you, the idea of genes being used in breast cancer has a rich history, starting with diagnosis. BRCA1 and BRCA2 were identified genetically years ago and have really changed the lives of women who happen to have that mutation. Herceptin, that antibody, guess how we make that antibody? The only way to make Herceptin as an antibody is to take a human gene for an antibody and put it in a cell using that same technique that I talked about, Paul Berg's and others' technique, and that's the only way you can make Herceptin. So when you talk about genes in cancer, they run the gamut from diagnosis to genetic therapies to the creation of new drugs. We would not be here in cancer today were it not for genetics and genetic engineering in particular.
Thank you.
How much promise do you feel there is in that area?
It depends on which arena. I mean, certainly with antibody therapies for cancer are one of the most striking therapies these days. So we are doing more and more, we are using them more and more. Again, would not be possible without genetic engineering. Genetics was used to figure out what an antibody was in the first place. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't know what an antibody was, how your immune system worked, if it wasn't for genetics. So genes underlie all of these really miraculous advances.
Yes.
Sorry, just to give another, the most obvious example. You know, remember this distinction in breast cancer between ER and PR? You know, we talk about ER, PR. Guess what those are? Genes. Estrogen receptor is a gene. Progesterone receptor is a gene. It's a marker for certain kinds of cancer. And if we didn't know that, we wouldn't know how to treat cancer, breast cancer, with tamoxifen.
And the doctors, physicians have had to learn this very quickly.
Absolutely. You have to learn all that genetics very, very quickly.
Yes.
Thank you. What do you make of, or how close do you think we are to potentially getting a cure for cancer? And do you think efforts like the President's Cancer Moonshot and others by Sean Parker and other Silicon Valley folks to try and kind of get toward a cure, how close do you think we might be?
So cure is a complicated word in cancer because it depends on the kinds of cancer that we're talking about. It has a very rich history detailed in another book. If you ask me about what I think about these moonshot efforts, I think they're helpful in some ways and they can be hurtful in others. I think they're helpful because they refocus our attention at a time when our attention span seems to have degenerated and we're talking about what I think are rather irrelevant issues when they're very clearly focused issues that we should be talking about, how to emancipate our health problems, how to help ourselves, how to help the economy, and so forth. And so rather than focusing on things that are not constructive, I think they allow us to rebuild faith in systems whether they be federally funded, whether they be philanthropically funded, they rebuild faith in systems that can provide medical transformations. So I think that's very helpful. The flip side, of course, is that that creates a certain cycle of hope and hype, and people say they've not met their, you know, technologies are not ready yet, they haven't met their goals. I think the moonshot will be partially successful because it'll allow us to clear out some cobwebs that have gotten in the way of advanced medical advances around cancer. I think there will be a backlash as well. You know, 10 years from now, we'll be sitting in this room and saying, "How dare we have said, you know, that there should be a moonshot for cancer?" I think cancers will advance significantly in the next decade. I'm confident of that.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes.
We have time for two more questions.
Okay. Thanks.
Hi. We've been talking mostly about like human genetics, but when it comes to policy and science being sort of ahead of policy, my first thought goes to GMOs.
Yeah.
And my understanding is that there's a huge gap between what is the scientific consensus and what the public perception is.
Yes.
So I was just curious in your work.
Yeah, you know, to be honest, I actually did not cover GMOs in this book because I really think it deserves a full second book. I'm not going to write it. The issue of genetically modified organisms. What I do though is I talk about the technologies to create transgenic organisms. Extensively in the book, but I don't go into the pros and cons and the pluses and minuses of genetically modified organisms. But in brief, the one thing I would say is that our sophistication in being able to create these organisms is increasing daily, and that obviously raises the specter of unintended consequences in the greater biosphere. I'm actually less concerned about the unintended consequences on human health locally. I'm more concerned about the greater unintended consequences in the biosphere at large, which is a much, much larger conversation, which we could have another time. But the important topic.
Thanks.
Okay. We won't count that as a question. We'll count that as a lead unto another conversation. So we'll take two more questions.
My question is almost identical to his.
Okay.
I was going to ask your opinion.
Yeah.
Okay,
sounds good. Thank you.
I wanted to know your opinion.
Yeah, thanks. All right.
Okay, hi. My name's Allison Burrell. I'm a graduate student finishing up at the National Institutes of Health, and recently I've gotten interested in science policy. And one of the questions that you had asked was, how much do the scientists who do the science talk to the policymakers? And you had responded something like, well, the scientists talk science and the policymakers talk government and they don't really communicate very well. But you do a great job and lots of other science writers do a great job of translating that really difficult science talk into understandable media. And so I was just wondering if you ever get the opportunity to talk to policymakers and participate in that.
Yeah, personally, I do a lot. I'm in Washington a lot. I've been to Congress several times, particularly around cancer. In fact, we screened part of Ken Burns' film in Congress. So I do. I think the problem is not that there isn't meeting spaces or meeting opportunities. The problem is that the vocabulary is different. And once the vocabulary becomes common, once we talk about the same things, it actually becomes much, much more easy, of course, to have the conversation. So part of the effort, I think, here is to at least arm ourselves with the vocabulary so that when you open the newspaper and someone says, you know, someone's trying to synthesize the human genome, at least we understand what that means. What does the human genome mean? What does it mean to synthesize the human genome? What are its implications down the road? And then we can have a real conversation. So thank you for reminding us that that's the kind of effort that's ultimately helpful. We need to have the vocabulary, as it were.
All right, thank you.
Okay, last question.
Well, my name is Marcel. Originally, I'm from the Czech Republic, so I understand what it's like.
Originally, I'm from India, so I understand what it's like. Let's have a drink.
So, a very simple question. Your opinion, do you think that in the future we'll be able to find smaller particles of genes, and for example, identify genes that define happiness, and since we are in the synagogue, genes of spirituality.
These are very interesting and complicated questions, and 10 years, 15 years ago, someone would say those are crazy questions. But 15 years later, they're not so crazy questions. I actually talk about this in the book a lot. Are there genes for temperament? Are there genes for personality, etc.? Almost always, these things are very higher order principles, as it were. They lie in intersections between genes and environments. But do I feel that some of these evanescent qualities have some components of genes at their core? The answer would be yes. Now, how do we know that the answer is yes? Because very, very detailed studies on identical twins separated at birth, separate is a famous study, which I talk about a lot. In fact, I interviewed one of the authors of that study for this book. These identical twins separated at birth, brought up in very different circumstances, share surprising kinds of behavior. They share personality traits that you wouldn't imagine would happen by random chance. They share preferences, anxieties. Now, what does that mean? That means that there must be things in the genome that predispose us to certain kinds of behaviors, temperaments, anxieties, etc. But what's also interesting is that if you look at not identical twins, but siblings, that number falls dramatically. What does that mean? That means that if you scatter genes around, you'll lose that effect. It's a very artificial effect. So it is simultaneously true that there are elements in the genome that may govern more complex evanescent traits of human personality, and that it's unlikely that we'll be able to manipulate them very easily because there are multiple genes that are governing this. I make the distinction in the book between the idea that these are inheritable, but they're not heritable.
It's a great question. Thank you very much. We're going to have to stop. I just want to say again, Sid, it's a fascinating book. Don't be intimidated by the fact that it's about science, because it's about people, it's about family, it's just done in a remarkably approachable way, and it's a wonderful read and a great book.
Thank you so much.
So it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.